Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hello. Terry and I like to watch reruns of The Last Man Standing. How many people have seen the sitcom The Last Man Standing, Tim Allen? We like to watch that. And the other night, Mike Baxter was talking to his middle daughter, and she was the understudy in a play, but she hadn't been studying her lines. So Mike said, "You got to do the work." That was his line that he kept repeating, "You got to do the work." When I teach composition to freshmen in college, I basically tell them the same thing. You got to do the work. Don't worry about it. Just get a rough draft down. And then when you revise, it's going to get better. And you keep doing that. And by the end, you're going to feel pretty good about what you put together. And then at the end of my inspirational talk, I say, well, there is one situation, though, that happens every now and then, and that is no matter how hard you keep working on it, it's just not going to happen, you know? It's just not going to work. So fortunately, we have deadlines, and you can turn it in and be done and move on to something else. I kind of feel that way this week. I put in a lot of work with today's sermon on Luke 16, verses 1 to 15. This has been the hardest one that I've worked on all summer, really struggling with it. And it's going to end up being a little bit more fragmented. So this is my way of telling you, come in with really low expectations. That way you will not be disappointed, okay? So the parable of the dishonest manager. I'm going to use the computer and use that, so we'll see if I can coordinate it all. So tonight's themes, a lot of fragments. I've got basically three different things that I ended up talking about. So we got fragments of money, a lot of money. Luke talks a lot about money, as you've discovered this summer semester that you're in. Luke talks a lot about money. His audience is a Greco-Roman secular audience primarily. He also talks to young Christians, but a lot of Greco-Roman citizens that he's talking to. I'm going to wander into the dangerous area of politics for just a little bit, and I'll go into there and try to get back out rather quickly. And then we'll finish up with the kingdom of God. And these three themes are going to weave as we go through this presentation. And I suppose we should really start with the passage. So take out your Pew Bible, and I think I will find a Pew Bible myself. And I believe it's on page 78 in the New Testament. So we're going to start by just taking a look at this challenging passage, page 79. Page 79, it's the parable of the dishonest manager. Luke 16, verses 1 to 15. So I'm just going to read through that to begin. Page 79. Then Jesus said to the disciples. So the disciples are there. He's talking to the disciples. Last time with the prodigal son, his primary audience were the Pharisees and the scribes. And they're still showing up here at the end of this passage. But primarily his audience is to his disciples. So we've got the disciples, we've got the Pharisees and scribes, and we've got the Roman citizens as the audience. Then Jesus said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was squandering his property. So he summoned him and said to him, what is this that I hear about you? Give me an accounting of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer. Then the manager said to himself, what will I do now that my master is taking the position away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do so that when I am dismissed as manager, people may welcome me into their homes. So summoning his master's debtors one by one, so we're assuming that there's quite a few of these debtors, he asked the first, how much do you owe my master? So obviously he's not keeping very good records because he's asking these people, you know, how much do you owe? He answered, 100 jugs of olive oil. He said to him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 50. Then he asked another, how much do you owe? He replied, 100 containers of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and make it 80. And his master commended, and then all of a sudden you got this shift here. It's like, what's going on here? Verse 8. And his master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. And then some commentary. For the children of this age are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than are the children of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into the eternal homes. That verses 8, 9 are still challenging to me after spending a week on them. And then we get into some uplifting passages. Verse 10, whoever is faithful in a very little is faithful also in much. And whoever is dishonest in a very little is dishonest also in much. If then you have not been faithful with the dishonest wealth, who will entrust to you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful with what belongs to another, who will give you what is your own? No slave can serve two masters, for a slave will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. And then that famous line, you cannot serve God and wealth, or you cannot serve God and mammon. And then a couple of extra lines at the end. Verse 14, the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all this, and they ridiculed him. So he said to them, you are those who justify yourselves in the sight of others, but God knows your hearts. For what is prized by human beings is an abomination in the sight of God. So there's today's reading. I'm just going to set this down here. Let's take a look at this. So my thoughts wandered around a bit here. Okay, so I'm reading all these different commentaries on what are the meanings of this passage, and different commentators really struggle with this. They're trying to make sense of how do we make sense of what the manager does, and why does he get praised afterwards by his master, the owner? So there's the first interpretation. Has to do with, well, one commentator said, well, I think this is about charging interest. And he places us, as you can see on the very bottom, the benefit takes account of cultural context, that in the Jewish culture, you are not allowed to charge interest to other Hebrews, other Jews. And I'll show you where that is. You shall not charge interest on loans to another Israelite, interest on money, interest on provisions, interest on anything that is lent. On loans to a foreigner, you may charge interest, but on loans to one another, to another Israelite, you may not charge interest, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all your undertakings in the land that you are about to enter and possess. So by not charging interest on each other, I think that adds to the sense of community within the Jewish community. Okay, now I'm going to head back here where I was. Okay, so in this scenario, we have the master must be an honest businessman. Oh, I'm sorry. Where am I? Okay. The master is a dishonest because he is violating the rule that you're not supposed to charge interest to the other Jews. So the master, dishonest. Steward, the manager, is honest, because he's following the Mosaic law. So he goes to these different creditors and charges them less because he knows that they should not be paying interest. The problem, though, in this scenario, the manager is the good guy. The problem, though, is there seems to be a very haphazard reduction in the bills. You know, one person's bill gets cut in half, one gets cut by 20%. The amount of interest, if this had to do with charging interest, it just wouldn't fit culturally, because the interest, even though it would have been high at that time, would not have been that high. So other commentators are saying, you know, this just doesn't quite make sense to me. So those are some of the pitfalls for interpretation number one. Other commentators then, for interpretation number two, say, well, I think the master is an honest businessman, and the steward is actually honest, although he's quite lazy, hasn't been keeping up with his accounts, so he decides to cut his commission. And that would reduce how much the debtors have to pay. The problem is pretty much the same thing, though. We have a haphazard reduction in bills, like we did before. One is cut 50%, one's cut 20%. The amount of commission probably would not have been that high, you know, double. The only way that it would have been that amount of commission is if he's a debt collector and he gets to keep half. Basically, today, if you have a debt that goes into debt collection, the company has already written it off and they give it to a bill collector and they say, you know what, whatever you can collect, you get to keep half and you give us the other half. So maybe, possibly, that could account for the amount of commission, but unlikely. The other problem, though, is elsewhere in this parable, this manager is really just focused on himself. So it seems to undermine or erode the idea that he is a honest manager. It looks like he's willing to do just about anything to get himself out of hot water. There is a benefit to this, though. Let's take a look at verse 8 again. And that's on the top of the second column on page 79. And his verse 8, and his master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. So he was astute. The owner says, you know what, that was pretty clever what you did there. You cut into your own commission in order to get payment from these people. Okay, so those are some of the benefits, the strong points and the weak points of that interpretation. Interpretation number 3 is what I just kept coming back to. This, well, maybe he's just lying. Maybe the manager is just lying. That in that case, you could have the master, the owner, who's an honest businessman. The steward, who is very self-centered. He deceives, he lies, he takes benefits while costing other people. It's his master, the owner, that ends up paying everything because the master didn't know exactly what the accounts were, how much they were, and the steward kind of had an idea. So the steward makes things better for himself by using the master's money and cutting the bills. And I keep coming back to this. The problem with that is back to verse 8 again. And his master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. So why would the dishonest manager praise the... I'm sorry. Why would the honest manager praise the dishonest... let me try this a third time. Why would an honest owner praise a dishonest manager if it cost the owner a bunch of money because the manager cut the people's bills? Now, even though that's a problem, it still does explain, though, if the manager is simply lying to the owner, then that would explain, that would get us out of this situation because the owner wouldn't know any better. He was lied to. And he just goes along with the lie and is oblivious to that lie. So I'll be talking about, you know, well, why then is lies effective at times? Do that right now. Why lies work. So as I'm working, so I thought that would be pretty much it for the presentation. 3 different interpretations. And then my brain kept spinning around. And then I started wondering, well, why do lies work? Why is it that lies are very effective at times? The first step for understanding something, if you hear something new, your brain immediately assumes that it's true. The first step for understanding is easy because the brain just naturally assumes the following. This is from Harvard University psychologist Daniel Gilbert. He argues that people see the world in 2 steps. We understand the world in 2 steps. First, even just briefly, we hold the lie as true. We must accept something in order to understand it. So if somebody's lying or somebody's telling a untruth or a deception, however you want to label it, in order to understand that, you have to at least for a moment assume it is true. And I know for myself and as I watch other people, I think that's true, that we people just tend to believe others unless something happens to convince us otherwise. We tend to be a pretty trusting species. Now, that was step one. We immediately assume the best. But the second step for understanding something takes some effort. And that's why our critical thinking sometimes just kind of shuts down for these reasons. Human minds, when faced with shortages of time, we're rushed. We're short of energy. You know, we've been just worn out. Or maybe there just isn't conclusive evidence. To the contrary, that it may fail to unaccept the ideas that they involuntarily accept during comprehension. In other words, you first hear something, you immediately believe it, and then you stop and say, well, should I believe that or not? Well, if you're tired, you probably say, you know what, I really don't want to think that hard. I got a lot of other things to do. I'm just going to move on to something else. I know I do that a lot. Okay, so why lies work? Okay, then I started thinking, well, what other stuff can I pile on to these thoughts? In my classes, in my rhetoric classes, I show my students some films by George Lakoff. He looks like Santa Claus. He looks very, very nice. And he has written books on framing. And it goes like this. His little example is, don't think of an elephant. Whatever you do, don't think of an elephant. How many of you right now are not thinking of an elephant? He says, some people claim that they're not thinking of it, but he doesn't believe them. So now you're all thinking of an elephant, right? And he says, that's framing. And really effective politicians and salespeople and probably people giving sermons are very good at framing, getting a certain way of looking at things into the people's brains. And George Lakoff says, the truth value really doesn't matter. The key is repeat it. Keep it simple, keep repeating it. Keep it simple, keep repeating it. And if you do that enough times, people just assume that it's true. And what happens is you create connections in the brain. These synapses start connecting. It's like Pavlov's dog. You hear something, and then you believe it. And the more you hear it, that's why you constantly are barraged with advertisements. Or if you come up to we're in the middle of an election, and you're wondering, why do they just keep repeating these messages? I already know who I'm going to vote for. What they're doing is reinforcing that constantly in our brains so that we don't even have to know the reasons why we're voting for somebody or why we're buying something. It's just common sense to us once those synapses connect. We're like Pavlov's dog. On top of that, to work even more against us, we have confirmation bias, as they call it. We tend to believe whatever supports our presuppositions. So we already want to believe certain things. And when somebody tells us what we want to hear, we hear that much. We are more likely to hear something that we want to hear than to hear something that goes against our assumptions of how the world works. So there's this confirmation bias, and they've done all kinds of interesting experiments with, you know, what do people actually hear? Well, what you hear is in many ways determined by what you want to hear. There was one singer that said, people only hear what they see. So he started dressing differently, and then people started accepting his songs more readily. Okay, so let's take these ideas, all these ideas that I've just thrown out there, and swirled around, and now let's consider the steward's repeated success. We have a steward. Now notice one thing that I just caught this afternoon as I was rereading this is this owner back in the beginning of this passage. He had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was squandering his money, his property, so he summoned him and said, what is this I hear about you? The owner's already made up his mind. Give me an accounting of your management because you cannot be my manager any longer. Okay, so maybe the owner is already thinking, you know what, I wonder if I should trust this guy. And then all of a sudden a rumor goes out and he hears it and he's like, oh, first thing I'm going to do is fire my manager. We don't know if the manager is lying or not. We don't know if the manager is truthful or not, but the owner is going to get rid of him. Okay, so now the manager has a problem. He, you know, the passage says what he does. He goes out, cuts these deals so that when he loses his job, he has some place to eat and sleep. And then he meets up with the owner. And I can just imagine that this manager is talking to the owner and saying, here's the debtor number one. And look, I collected what was due for you, okay? And here's number two. And look, I collected what was due to you, what was owed to you. And here's number three. And here's number four. And every time he pulls out another receipt, yeah, the receipts were modified, but he actually collected the money. So now we've got this manager who is reinforcing, he's using framing to get across the idea that, hey, I am a worthy manager. So he's doing those very things that George Lakoff had mentioned, that framing just relies upon repetition. Okay, now, so we got all this going on, right? And then I'm thinking, well, oh boy, if I'm going to teach this, I should really come up with an example, a modern example. And I kept getting myself in trouble because all I kept thinking about was Donald Trump. And then I started thinking, I wish I was more like Rich, because Rich is basically blissfully oblivious to politics. And I try to be. And I just feel like I just keep getting sucked back in again. It's like in Godfather 3 where he tries to get out of the mob. And he says, every time I try to get out, they just suck me back in again. And that's the way I feel with politics. And it's like, I shouldn't even watch. I shouldn't read the newspaper, but I can't help myself. So I'm watching the debates. I'm thinking this week, well, you know, Donald Trump keeps coming into my head. So I'm thinking back to the presidential debates back last fall. It might have been the second one, I'm not sure. And Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton thought she had Donald Trump and said, you haven't been paying, you've written off all of these losses on your Atlantic City casinos and you have these massive write-offs. So Donald Trump admitted to not paying taxes, at least for 1 year. And he applied his Atlantic City write-offs for the losses. Better get this coordinated here. He applied the Atlantic City write-offs for the losses. Okay? So he admits, lost a lot of money in Atlantic City, had a lot of write-offs, so now it reduces my federal income tax. He pays a lot of other taxes, but Hillary was talking about federal income taxes. And yet, at the same time, Donald Trump is doing a fabulous job of framing who he is as a candidate. He kept repeating, vote for me because I am a successful businessman. He presented himself as an Atlantic City success. And I'm like, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. You know, I'm kind of confused. He's saying I lost a bunch of money, and he's also saying I'm a success. So what's going on here? And I was a little surprised that nobody really seemed to be questioning this. How can you have it both ways? So last night, late into the evening, it started really bugging me. And I'm like, well, how could that be? How could he make all this money and have all these write-offs? So I found this article last night, how Donald Trump bankrupted his Atlantic City casinos but still earned millions of dollars. And it's true, he filed bankruptcy about four different times. He had three different casinos. He was overbuilt in Atlantic City, but he himself made lots and lots of money through what he paid himself and also some other lots of tax credits that he was able to use. So this is what I found out. Okay, so again, this is, I'm trying not to be overly political. I'm just trying to use this as an example of a steward, a manager, like the manager in the tale. So Fortune magazine, a fairly conservative magazine, the prevailing wisdom that has emerged in the past week, this was back last October, in the past week among accounting experts is that Trump was able to use more than $900 million in paper losses to reduce his taxable income via a loophole in the code that allowed losses of private businesses registered as S corporations to flow to their owners, even when they didn't put any of their own cash into the companies. So an S corporation is, you get the tax benefits, but if the business goes belly up, you're not responsible to pay back that money. The title, oops, I'm going to keep going here. So one of the subtitles was Donald Trump got a tax break for stiffing contractors. So one of the problems was he had all these contractors working on these casinos, and when he went bankrupt, they only got about 30 cents on the dollar. So they gave a Ma and Pa construction company, did $230,000 worth of business, but only got $70,000 in the bankruptcy court. And so this journalist says, those creditors were the ones who really had the money at risk, not Trump. So the big banks, Citibank and manufacturers, Hanover, they had the money at risk, not Trump. And so, as so often in the Trumpian universe, the folks who funded him and in some cases supplied the brawn and the brick, these contractors that built his empire, were the ones who lost out while the Donald won. So he did, in fact, make lots of money, but his businesses went bankrupt. Oops. So, I got to get to the next one. Okay, so I'm going to get out of that realm of the politics and back into some general ideas. So why such little questioning? Because it didn't seem to fit when I was watching these debates. Well, he seems to be doing the framing that George Lakoff talks about. And now I'm putting these ideas in your brain, and you're not going to be able to get them out. So now you're going to go out, and you'll be watching how different people use framing all the time in their everyday lives. Repeat the message and image. I'm a successful business person. I'm a great singer. I'm a wonderful runner. So we just keep repeating the same things over and over. Seems to me that Americans, because we're such a consumer-driven society, we worship the rich and the famous. Not just us, it's some other countries too. But we would not have shows like The Lives of the Rich and the Famous if there wasn't a market for it. So we seem to worship the rich and the famous. Donald Trump, rich and famous. We want to be rich too. We want to be rich. And there's some certain confirmation bias going on here. If she or he is rich, then he or she must be doing something right. So if I want to be rich, and I do want to be rich, then I should do what they're doing. And besides that, it just seems like good business practice. So even though you file bankruptcy and you have all these write-offs, it's still just business practices, and you should do it. If you can take advantage of it, you should take advantage of it. So in our passage, we had the word shrewd. So I looked up from HarperCollins English Dictionary a couple of definitions of shrewd. The first one is more positive, keen-witted, clever, or sharp in practical affairs, astute. Then the second one is also positive, but it has a little connotation of negativity to it. A shrewd person is able to understand and judge a situation quickly and use this understanding to their own advantage. So in our parable, what did the steward do? What did that manager do? He surveyed very quickly the situation and realized, hey, if I just go to those debtors and I cut them a deal, I can set things up for myself in the future. Christian's response, a transcendent value, is kind of a theme that I keep coming back to this summer. Let's take a look at that nice passage in Luke 16 again. Let's take a look at verse 10. As you do that, I'm going to grab some water. So I like to summarize things. And I'm thinking, be faithful in the little things. What is within your control? Life is overwhelming. What is in your control? Break it down. Just keep plodding along. God does not demand results. God expects faithfulness. Maybe too often we think we have to be a success in whatever God calls us to do. The first week, the calling of Peter, I had mentioned listen and act and follow. The command was not be a success. The command was do as I tell you to do. So be faithful. Let's take a look at those verses again. These are the nice verses in today's reading. Verse 10, whoever is faithful in a very little is faithful also in much. It doesn't matter how little the task is that I'm working on at the time. It might be at home, it might be at work, it might be helping a person. It doesn't matter how little it is, because everything that I do is a way of developing my character, and God can be using anything and everything that happens to me to prepare me for something else. It's never just about what it's about. And whoever is dishonest in a very little is dishonest also in much. If then you have not been faithful with the dishonest wealth, so basically anything to do with the world, who will entrust to you the true riches, the spiritual, the good stuff? And if you have not been faithful with what belongs to another, who will give you what is your own? No slave can serve two masters, for a slave will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. So what I take away, I love those verses in the beginning because it reminds me, no matter if I don't understand what's going on in my life, God, why are you doing this to me? Why am I going through this? It doesn't matter, because all I have to do is be faithful in every little task that comes my way. I don't know where it's going to go, and I don't need to know where it's going to go. All I've got to do is take care of that detail. Now, my personality is I tend to be very meticulous anyway, so that interpretation works really well for me. And it drives Carrie nuts because it takes me forever to do anything. But be faithful in the little things. All right, then I thought, well, I walked into that minefield of political stuff. I better at least come back to it quickly. Maneuvering the political waters. Okay. So I started thinking about it. Okay, we're in church. I'm going to have different political views, and it'd be nice to be able to at least talk about some of these things without, you know, yelling at each other. But the opposite is usually true. Usually people just don't talk about those issues. So how, if we wanted to have conversation, how would we do it? Well, number one, keep all political parties accountable to godly principles, such as Micah 6:8, do justice and love mercy. Keep everybody accountable. Democrats, be accountable. Republicans, be accountable. Libertarians, be accountable. Green Party, be accountable. All those other parties, be accountable. What are the standards? A couple weeks ago, I had mentioned transcendent values. How do we decide between different good choices? Well, all we can do is have a higher level of values, and then we apply those. So as Christians, then, I think it's our responsibility to keep everybody accountable. Some people, Dave Seamuth, who I've taken classes with at Elmbrook Church, he just divorces himself from interacting with basically politics in the world. He says, you know, no matter who's in charge, it's going to be bad. And he just says, what, as a Christian, we should not even be involved. And that's a fine approach. But like I said, I keep getting sucked back in. I can't get out. So I needed some kind of method to come up with. How do I interact with these issues? Well, number one, I can look at these parties and I can say, are they fulfilling the objectives, the commands that I read about every day in the Bible? Next item, propriety. We get the word appropriate from that. Does the solution solve a problem? evaluate individual bills, individual solutions on their merit. Wouldn't it be nice if all of a sudden somebody in the Democratic Party would stand up and say, you know what, I really like what that Republican said over there. He really had a good solution. Or if a Green Party member stood up and said, I really like what that Libertarian said over there. I think that's going to work. I've been listening to TED Talks every now and then, and lately they've been having a lot of programs where they look at cities. And they say, you know, the cities don't seem to be having as much problem as the state and federal government, mainly because they don't have the time to worry about ideology and politics. They've got a sewer line that needs to get fixed. How are we going to do it? Let's get some bids. Let's get this done. So they're very pragmatic at the city level. So propriety, does this actually solve a problem? That seems like a good question to ask also. And then finally, place godly standards above party loyalty. I think sometimes we just get so hung up and grounded and dig in our heels that my party's right and your party's always wrong. Well, no, that's ridiculous. Because some of the things that my party does is good. And some of the things that my party does is really stupid. And some of the things that your party does is really good. And some of the things that your party does is really stupid. And let's talk about those practical things. So what I've been trying to do is come up a way where I can continue to be at least somewhat engaged, at least be able to vote and not go crazy and not feel like I'm committed to a certain party or a certain candidate. Why? Because above all else, I serve Jesus Christ. And I've got a manual here that I read every day, and it's a lot of stuff, but I try to bounce what's happening in society with what I read about. And that's my best effort. What to make of Luke 16:9. Take a look at verse 9. Verse 9, towards the top of the second column. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into the eternal homes. The commentators really didn't know what to do with this, and neither did I. But one of the commentators said, this parable is really all about urgency. He basically said, it's not even that much about money. It's about urgency. Do not make money your prize. Instead, use money the way it should be used. Use money to help other people. So when I talked about stewardship, why do we manage our money? So that we can get rich and take vacations? Would it be nice? But ultimately, we manage our money so that we can give more to those people who don't have it. That's the end point of good stewardship. So the New Interpreter's Bible goes right to the point. So now that I've been going all over the place, I've been wandering left and right and up and down tonight, here's something that goes right to the point. Through the parable, therefore, Jesus admonishes his hearers to cast caution aside, seize the moment of opportunity, and make provisions for their future before God. The kingdom is at hand. So that this interpreter said, this is really about that steward realizing, I don't have much time, I better kick it in gear. And he says, Christians, look at your situation, say, what can I do right now? What do I need to do? Time to set the excuses to the side and get on with whatever it is that God wants me to do. Okay. So like I said, at the very beginning of this, I was going to wander all over the place, and hopefully I did. Where have we been? Summary time. Well, handle money ethically as good stewards. We don't have a great model here in this passage, but the implication is we should be good stewards, take good records, and pay our bills. Second, keep politics accountable to ethical standards. That just sort of came in out of nowhere because I couldn't get it out of my brain. Third, have a sense of urgency in serving God's kingdom and helping others. And that goes back to verse 9. And finally, You got to serve somebody. At the end of that nice passage, at the end of verse 13, you cannot serve God and wealth. There's a song, and I can't quite remember the lyrics to it. Everybody serves somebody. I think it's something like you can serve the Lord or the devil, but you have to serve somebody. Maybe Bill can... Nothing. Glenn's kind of thinking, yeah, kind of. I kind of remember something like that. Everybody serves somebody. You don't have a choice. I don't have a choice. We will all serve somebody. So I thought of Joshua 24:15. As for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. So after all is said and done about politics, about money, it's nice to know that there is one thing that is still the most important of all, and that is being in the presence of God. When everything else gets really confusing, all we got to do is go back to the well. We just got to go back to God's presence. And all of a sudden, all these other things that get me all worked up during the week don't seem very important anymore. And then we get to come to church on Wednesday and Sunday, and then we kind of readjust our dial, and we realize just keep close to God, and everything else seems to work out pretty well. Choose God, not mammon, or power, or stuff, or anything else. And this is where I get to bring Glenn in, who offered to give me a bunch of money because it's just stuff, anyway. No, I'm just kidding. So choose God. Everything else is just stuff. The power fades, comes and goes. It's all stuff. But you know what? God is God. And now we get to worship God. So at this time, the worship team can come back up and you can put together your prayer requests as we come to the altar of God.